Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, the future of live music and chart battles. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when Saudi Arabia took a 5.7% stake in Live Nation.
Yes. I feel I have to preempt what I'm about to say by explaining that I'm reading something that Andy Malt wrote in a sort of little script. I don't want to take responsibility for the next line. So are we ready? Here we go. Yes, an actual nation buying part of a pretend nation. Writes Andy Malt.
Live Nation is a pretend nation.
Well, it's a company that has nation in its name. I think it would be unfair to suggest that Michael Rapino, the CEO of Live Nation, is under any delusion that he is actually running a real nation state.
I don't know. Have you ever asked him?
I have never had the chance to ask him. That is true. And what is definitely now true is that while he is not in charge of a nation state, maybe a nation state is in charge of him. Because as you say, the country of Saudi Arabia last week went to the stock market and bought itself a load of Live Nation stock. So not off the company itself, off existing Live Nation shareholders, bought some shares on the open market, which means that the country of Saudi Arabia, through its investment fund, because it has an investment fund, now has 5.7% of Live Nation. Although, possibly aware that Saudi Arabia is quite a controversial country in some quarters, particularly among quite a lot of the creative community, the investment fund of Saudi Arabia was very keen to stress that this is a very much a passive investment. It's not expecting to have any particular control over the running of the company. And although this share purchase does make it the third biggest shareholder overall in Live Nation, it's still quite some way behind the biggest shareholder when it comes to percentage of stock.
No, that would be Liberty Media, which owns 33%, which is quite a lot more than Saudi Arabia now owns.
Yeah, and that's despite Saudi Arabia spending a reported $500 million on this share acquisition into Live Nation. And I suppose the reason why this share purchase is interesting, well, I mean, for starters, the fact that a politically controversial country, Saudi Arabia, now has a significant stake in the biggest live music company in the world, that is interesting in itself. But there's been lots of reporting on Live Nation's share price in recent weeks because of the COVID-19 shutdown. Obviously, Live Nation's primary business is all about venues and tours and festivals and ticketing, all of which have been majorly affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. And the share price as a result of that has been taking quite a hammering. Management at Live Nation, including Michael Rapino, have been trying to reassure investors that the company is doing all the right things to weather this storm and that it will come out the other end as powerful as ever. And I mean, you could argue that the middle-sized live music companies and the middle-sized ticketing companies are going to be the hardest hit, sadly, as a result of COVID-19, which could actually mean at the end of all of this, Live Nation, already an incredibly dominant player in live music, especially in places like the US and the UK, will be even more dominant. So providing you're willing to play for the long haul, because the shares are probably going to be a little bit up and down in the months ahead, but if you're willing to play for the long haul, then possibly a wise investment while the share price is down. So that may well be why Saudi Arabia had decided that now was the time to go to the stock market and get a stake of Live Nation. So that was one of the things that did happen in the last 7 days, but crucially, not one of the things we're here to talk about.
No, actually this week we're going to be discussing the success of COVID-19 charity singles in the UK. And first, this. A poll carried out for Reuters by Ipsos last week found that less than half of Americans plan to return to sports events, live music, cinemas and amusement parks until a COVID-19 vaccine is found, even if lockdown restrictions are lifted before then. This then suggests, as feared, that the live industry faces a difficult future for some time yet.
Yeah, this Reuters report actually came out shortly after it had been announced that Saudi Arabia had taken their 5% stake in Live Nation. Would it have had an impact on that decision? Probably not, for the reason I've just said. In a weird sort of way, if the live industry is going to be facing challenges for, you know, a longer period of time than we all hoped, then in some ways, Live Nation is best equipped to weather that storm and could still come out of it at the other end stronger. But yeah, interesting piece of research, because obviously Since the COVID-19 shutdown began and the live industry in multiple countries around the world basically stopped almost overnight, there have been lots of debates about how long is the live industry going to be in limbo. You know, are we talking about weeks? Initially, optimists, and I think I was one of the optimists, initially it was like, okay, maybe we're talking about a month here. Then it became pretty clear, no, we're definitely talking about months before, you know, we get back to anything resembling a normal life and being able to go to pubs, clubs, bars, cafes, and for live music to resume. We're definitely talking about months here. But there are some pessimists out there who are saying, actually, we're talking years. And I suppose what was interesting about this report was there were two elements to this, aren't there? Which is, one, there's the government instigated measures. So where governments in multiple countries around the world have said, okay, venues aren't allowed to open, no gatherings over a certain number. And yes, in some countries in Asia and now elsewhere in Europe as well, some of those restrictions are starting to be wound down. Not entirely in most places, it has to be said, but you know, they are slowly lifting the lockdown. So let's say across a lot of Europe and North America, at some point in the next few months, lockdown kind of comes to an end and certain aspects of life return to normal. There is then the question of, well, at what point does that mean venues reopen? And it may well be that there'll be a different time scale for small venues versus large venues. But even once the government restrictions are out of the way and venues are allowed to open again, whether we're talking about small venues or big venues, the other big unknown, the other big question is, will the people come back? You know, will the audience members, when they're allowed to start going to venues to watch shows, will they? And yeah, as you said, what this report suggested, this was a survey of American consumers. So it was a US-centric piece of research, but it showed that there was quite a lot of concern amongst potential ticket buyers that we could see future spikes of COVID-19 in the year ahead, and therefore they were nervous about putting themselves and family members at risk by rushing back to big sporting events, concerts, festivals, even going to the cinema and things like that. So it could be that the live industry is not only waiting for government to lift the restrictions, it's also waiting for the public at large to feel comfortable again going to places where they are in close proximity to lots of other people.
So this poll mainly focused on sporting events, and most of the stats were relating to that. It found that amongst the people interviewed, only 17% would consider going to a sporting event before a vaccine for COVID-19 was found. Now, maybe some of the people wouldn't go to a sporting event anyway, so they did drill it down into people who routinely go to sporting events, maybe hold season tickets, that sort of thing. And even there, it found that only 42% would consider going, with 39% of those saying they'd be happy to wait more than a year for a vaccine before they went to an event.
Yeah, I suppose that's the important aside to these statistics, isn't it? Is these people saying, we're worried there's going to be another spike of COVID-19 at some point in the year ahead, so we don't want to put ourselves at risk until there's a vaccine. But, you know, how long will it take for a vaccine to be identified and tested? And obviously, lots of people around the world are currently trying really hard to find a vaccine for this virus. But there are, again, so many unknowns, and plenty of people say it will be at least a year, possibly 18 months, until we have a vaccine that has been both proven to work and then properly tested. And if that is the case, so if people are saying we don't want to go back to big events until there's a vaccine, and then we're saying over here a vaccine is at best a year away, well, that's quite a long time we're talking about before people are going to go back. Well, for sporting events, it did also talk a little bit, didn't it, about culture and entertainment. I think it probably grouped all the different sorts of entertainment together.
Yeah.
But we got a little bit of an insight on the music side as well.
Yeah, so as you say, live music was grouped in with theatre and cinema, so we don't get quite as clear a picture as what we got for sport. But even there, only 27% of people said they would go to any of those types of shows before a vaccine is found. 32% said that they would be willing to wait a long time for a vaccine, which, I mean, those numbers maybe sound a little bit better than for sport, but also 55% of people asked said that they didn't think that this type of event should go ahead at all until there was a vaccine. So no live music, no theatre performances, and no films released in cinemas for possibly a year or more.
So that's quite depressing reading for a lot of the entertainment industry, who are hoping that the government restrictions will be lifted in the months ahead, certainly for sort of smaller level events. But, you know, as I say, this research suggesting even once the government restrictions are lifted, there will still be a fewer people interested in attending. Obviously, some people have talked about potential solutions. So one of those is allowing sporting events to go ahead, for example, but without a crowd, and then filming them and then broadcasting that and live streaming it. And I suppose the equivalent in music would be that the venues reopen, the artists go in, everybody's very careful, the bands and all the production crew are very careful when they're in the venue, and the whole thing is live streamed. And Reuters did speak to some of the people on the sporting side of that and saying, well, you know, what do you think about the idea of you know, all the big sports leagues starting up again, but not actually having a live audience and it all being streamed on the internet and available by TV? And there was some support for that.
Yeah, 59% of the people surveyed said that they thought streaming crowd-free events was a good idea, while a third disagreed. I don't know, I guess you might think that that's not a fun way to watch sport or music, but I mean, people watch sport on TV all the time. I don't see why you'd be so against it. I guess it's slightly different with music, although I did actually in the last week watch a gig in a venue. I went to a gig. It was in a small venue near me. I should stress that no one came into contact with each other during this process. There was a solo artist on stage who came in one door of the venue. There was a sound engineer who came in a different door. There was someone who had previously set up video equipment and then was in another part of the venue. And then the audience, including me, paid £3 to watch it at home. But I watched it to see if it would work. And actually, it kind of did. And I suppose that is one answer to how we get venues up and running again before there's a vaccine, especially if people are just going to be unwilling to go out. Venues need to make money to survive. And so maybe this is one answer to how that could be possible.
Yeah, I suppose that's a sort of a halfway house solution, isn't it? Because obviously what we've seen in recent weeks is lots of artists doing live streaming from their homes and from their living rooms and their kitchens. And people have been quite excited about that. But you do sort of have to feel there's an element of novelty value about that, isn't there? I mean, often the production quality isn't as great, the streaming quality isn't as great, and initially it's kind of fun watching a pop star performing in their house. But actually, maybe, you know, obviously not a long-term solution, I don't think, but, you know, before we get to a point where venues are able to properly get back into action, yeah, maybe that is it. We carry on doing the live streaming thing, but the artists are going to their local venues and everybody is very careful when they're in the venue on the production crew side. So it's still live streaming, but obviously a better production standards, better sound quality, etc.
I mean, I think there's possibly an argument for venues doing that anyway. And if it's proven to be something that people are willing to pay for. I mean, I often can't go to gigs because I have children and I'm not allowed outside even when there isn't a virus. So I probably would pay occasionally, you know, a few quid to see a gig on my TV that I couldn't get to, but, you know, I was really keen to see. And for small venues where sometimes that small capacity means it is quite hard to make money, if you can increase the number of people who can pay for a show by having it streaming outside, maybe that could be a positive thing for small venues ongoing and even the wider live industry.
Although there would be the added interesting factor in the short term, rather than that being something that we do forever, but if there was a period where that was the only way that we could do it because there were still some restrictions in place, it would have the added fun factor that artists would have to play at their nearest venue, wouldn't they? Rather than the venue that they consider to be appropriate for the level they are in their career. And obviously, if you're not having anyone in the building, it doesn't really matter if you're playing a small venue. So that would be quite fun because it would mean that, you know, there'll be some people who live in slightly random places in the country who are a 10-minute drive away from a venue that they would never normally play, but they might do. So it would have an extra quirky feature to it.
Yeah, you're right. There's that. I mean, you could argue there's maybe a novelty to that that would wear off over time. I mean, you said that the home performance is probably the novelty of those is going to wear off. Maybe, in fact, you know, the novelty of watching this even in a proper venue is going to wear off. However, there was some other research that came out last week that suggested that people do actually quite like it. Another piece of US research, this time by the talent agency group UTA, who found that 90% of regular gig goers had already gone out and found streamed events to fill that gap in their usual entertainment of going out and watching bands live. And 70% of those who had been accessing live stream shows said that they plan to continue doing so even once the pandemic is over. So perhaps this is something that can continue.
Yeah, that feeds into the conversation about we've seen this spike in live streaming. There's all the ongoing debates about how we monetize. Can we monetize those live streams? There's those copyright issues we talked about on last week's set list. But people are speculating, you know, is this just a temporary blip while we're in lockdown? Or is this now that live streaming is going to become a legitimate mainstream part of the music industry? It's something that most artists do. It's maybe another way that artists ultimately can make money. Or, as we've said at several points, is it just a temporary thing? And once we can go back to proper venues, we will want to. But yeah, this interesting, this research. I should suppose add, of the 90% of people they surveyed, so I think they surveyed just over 1,000 people in America, who were finding other ways to entertain themselves because they couldn't go to live entertainment or to live music, etc. Not all of those were taking the live streaming option. So some were simply scouring YouTube for archive footage of their favourite artists performing live. Some actually were just being more proactive in accessing catalogues of the artists they like on Spotify. But a decent proportion have been tuning into these live streams. And actually, of those, a decent portion, again, had said they'd actually paid for some of these streams. But yeah, the really interesting thing about that research was the suggestion that maybe this will live beyond shutdown, which again raises the question, what does that mean? Does that mean artists performing from home in the long term? Or is it something more like what we've just been talking about, where artists will go back to performing in venues, but the venues have a double life? One day they are a traditional venue, everyone's coming in live, but the next day they sort of become a recording studio for a live stream gig that then is subsequently available on demand. As with everything to do with COVID-19, we just don't know. So all we can do is speculate. But it was quite interesting to see these two reports coming out of America last week, the Reuters one and the one from the talent agency group UTA. I suppose the other thing to quickly acknowledge with this whole fear that it could take a lot longer for the live entertainment industry to get back into action than we'd originally hoped. The other thing that some people have talked about is, well, is there anything we can do at the venues with so-called social distancing to allay these fears? So these customers who are saying, even once the government restrictions are gone, we don't want to come back because we're frightened that there might be another spike in the disease down the line. Well, could we instigate things in venues like people have done in supermarkets to make it that people could still go to a live event without being in too close contact with other people so that the risk is there? And various people have speculated about that in terms of sport, in terms of theatre, in terms of music, mainly for seated shows, obviously. I think venues where everybody's standing, it would be incredibly hard to enforce. Although it has to be said, even for seated venues, if you think about it, you'd have to reduce the capacity to such an extent to instigate the sort of social distancing that we've been trying to instigate in supermarkets, that it would almost certainly be the case that it would not be viable for those venues to open, because there's a certain number of people you have to get through the door. Otherwise, you're going to make a financial loss. So I'm not sure the idea that we can instigate some social distancing at venues is going to be realistic.
No, if you think you've got to have 2 meters around every seat that someone's sitting in, that's a lot of empty seats.
But I suppose the other thing that we might want to throw in there, given that I always feel with all things to do with COVID-19, one day you've got a report that makes you feel very pessimistic about everything, and then the next day a report that makes you feel a little bit more optimistic. In terms of the people who've been saying, particularly in the Reuters survey, about even once the government restrictions are out of the way, they won't want to go back to large-scale events. They were being asked that question right in the middle of the pandemic, when they're being surrounded by messaging of doom and gloom and, you know, of all the risk, and everyone's on complete alert. And who knows, it might be that in 6 months' time, once the lockdown measures are being reduced and we're turning something more like a normal life, even though almost certainly at that point a vaccine won't have been found, you might find that people have a slightly different attitude at the end of the year than they currently have. So when it comes to the attitudes of consumers rather than the laws and the rules being passed by governments, it might be that that's in flux. And I guess, presumably, other people will be researching similar groups of people in the months ahead, and we'll see whether or not there's any changing opinion in that regard.
Yes, so no doubt we'll have lots more stats and reports to talk about in the coming months until we eventually get to see how it all actually turns out. And finally this week, one thing we have seen booming in the COVID-19 pandemic is the good old charity single. In the last 2 weeks, we've seen two different charity singles hit the top of the UK singles chart, although both had to fight off fierce competition from The Weeknd's very much non-charitable Blinding Lights.
Yeah, both these singles released here in the UK were raising money for charities helping deal with the COVID-19 pandemic. The first was a cover of You'll Never Walk Alone, which I don't know, I always think of as being a Gerry and the Pacemakers song, because it was, although originally it's in a stage musical, isn't it?
I believe so, yes.
Rodgers and Hammerstein, I think. But anyway, this was Michael Ball singing You'll Never Walk Alone. He was supported by the NHS choir. But crucially, the real thing with this single was that it also featured Captain Tom Moore, who was the guy who raised a ludicrous amount of money for NHS charities. He was approaching his 100th birthday. He and his family decided that it would be fun to have him do 100 laps of his back garden and get people to donate money through a sort of Just Giving website online, hoping to raise £1,000, say, for NHS charities. And then the whole thing went super viral on the social networks. And in the end, more than £30 million was pledged for NHS charities. And this whole thing became a big news story here in the UK and I think around the world as well. And very quickly, the idea came we should do a single around this, try and get it to number one for Captain Tom's actual 100th birthday. So as I say, it was Michael Ball and the NHS choir singing You'll Never Walk Alone, and then Captain Tom Moore, in essence, speaking the lyrics. And it's always tricky, isn't it, with charity singles? Let's not give a critique of the actual track. But it's a lovely story, and the video version is really good. And it got to number one, but only just because, as you say, although these charity singles have been getting people excited on the social networks and people have been streaming them and people have been buying them, pop stars are continuing to put out music, and that The Weeknd insists on still being pretty damn popular on the streaming platforms. And he very nearly deprived Captain Tom Moore and all of those people trying to raise money for the NHS their number one spot. Although, to be fair to The Weeknd, it was possible that his intervention secured Captain Tom is number one.
Yes, because Blinding Lights by The Weeknd has been very popular over here and, I mean, everywhere. He's popular, isn't he? He's a popular guy. But he's had 8 non-consecutive weeks at the top of the UK singles chart with this track. And prior to being knocked off by Captain Tom, he'd been up there for 6 straight weeks. And it looked like he was going to do it again up until right at the last moment. Captain Tom did start the week quite strongly at number one, but The Weeknd caught up over the course of the week and overtook him. And it was right, really close to the final cutoff for that week's chart that The Weeknd tweeted about it and said, please don't listen to my song. Play this instead. This guy needs to go to number one for his 100th birthday. It's a great story. He's a great guy. Stop listening to me. And I mean, whether or not that is what actually did it, it's a nice conclusion to the story. So let's say that it did. And then on that Friday afternoon, Captain Tom and Michael Ball were at number one. And so it is a record-breaking single. As a result, Captain Tom became the oldest person to ever have a UK number one single at 99 years old. He beat the previous record holder, Tom Jones, by more than 30 years. So that's pretty good. And then later that week, when his birthday actually rolled around and he turned 100, he became the first 100-year-old to ever have a UK number one single. So 2 records broken in the space of 7 days, £30 million raised from just walking around his garden. He's released a single. It's quite eventful, really, isn't it?
And on top of all of this meant that when that 100th birthday actually came round, a significant portion of the UK population were celebrating that birthday with him, because this was such a sort of, good, warm-hearted story in amongst all the COVID-19 pandemic. Of course, I mean, there have been a number of opinion editorials in the broadsheet newspapers pointing out that really we shouldn't have to be raising money for our NHS through charity initiatives. But providing we're willing to put that, albeit good political point, to the side, this has been a really nice story. And so, yeah, on his birthday, on 100th birthday, Spotify gave us some stats and they told us that more people were tuning into that song on his actual birthday. But also, it was inspiring people to listen to any song with the word birthday in the title.
Yeah, Spotify released some stats around this after Captain Tom's birthday last Thursday, noting that there had been a 117% increase in global streams of his version of You'll Never Walk Alone on his birthday, and 144% increase in the UK on its own. But not only that, as you say, there was also this little bump for songs that just have happy birthday in the title. There was a 12% increase for those over the previous day. So I guess people were just sitting at home playing happy birthday to themselves as some sort of celebration.
But we have to say, despite that spike of listening on his actual birthday, and despite this being this heartwarming story that everybody has been enjoying following, this surprise overnight pop star only had 1 week at the top of the UK singles charts. partly because people are still bloody streaming the bloody Weekend track, but also because we had our second charity single released almost immediately after the Captain Tom single, and that was the BBC's All-Star Live Lounge recording, which involves a whole load of great artists and musicians, all of whom were in lockdown, and so all of whom had to record their bits from their houses.
Yeah, so the Live Lounge, I mean, I think the Live Lounge is known outside the UK, but it's a long-running feature on BBC Radio 1 where artists come into the studio and they perform one of their tracks and they perform a cover. And they, I mean, those covers tend to get the most coverage for it in the UK and worldwide. And in this case, obviously, no artists were coming into the studio to do this. But the BBC hit on the idea of doing, I guess, like a Band-Aid style recording, but obviously without the artist coming into a studio to record, they all recorded their parts of a cover of Foo Fighters' Times Like These in their homes and then sent them all in for them to be stitched together into the final track. So you had a whole load of artists, including Chris Martin, Dua Lipa, AJ Tracy, Bastille, and even Dave Grohl and Taylor Hawkins from the Foo Fighters on this track. It was then debuted simultaneously across all of the BBC's music radio stations. And then that same night, there was a big TV telethon raising money for Children in Need and Comic Relief. And the video for the track was premiered on there. So it had quite a big boost to get it going. I mean, such a big boost that it got to number 5 in that week's chart, even though this all happened just hours before the actual cutoff for that week's chart.
Yeah, that was quite impressive that we had that immediate flurry of sales. So it debuted on BBC Radio. They had the video on the telephone and then the single went on sale. It was available to stream in aid of the same charities as the telephone in the UK. So Comic Relief, Children in Need, although people who stream and buy it outside of the UK, it's going to the WHO COVID-19 fund. But, you know, to have such an immediate interest in the track that, as you say, within a few hours, really, it had enough sales and streams to go to number 5 immediately on the next day's music chart. Although, possibly with hindsight, well, obviously they wanted to get to number 1 in the first full chart week after the release. And just like the Captain Tom record the previous week, it was touch and go. Maybe they were regretting it, because if they'd released the track a few hours later after it had been played on the radio, all of those initial sales that got it to number 5 in the first chart it appeared in would have carried over to the following chart week, if you understand what I mean. But there's a good news ending to this as well. So we had yet another chart battle. Poor The Weeknd, who's just being portrayed as the pop star who's stopping all of these spirit-raising charity tracks from getting to the top of the chart. It did look like it might be that the Times Like These cover would be at number 2 with The Weeknd at number 1, but actually, in the end, without The Weeknd intervening this time, I don't know if his fans took it upon themselves to do it in his absence, because he didn't post a tweet telling people to stream or buy the charity track. But nevertheless, it still got to number 1.
Yes, but only just. I mean, it was very tight. In the end, there were 3,000 sales that separated the Stay Home Live Lounge track and The Weeknd's track, so it was incredibly close.
I'd like to claim responsibility for this, because I actually downloaded the track through the iTunes store.
Did you? You and many other people. In fact, that's another stat I can drop on you right now. There were 66,000 equivalent sales of the track.
Those being streams that are somehow mashed together to equate to sales.
Yes, we can't talk about just sales. But 78% of those were actual sales of downloads to people like you.
Yeah, opened up the iTunes store, dusted it off, noticed that the bloody U2 album had re-downloaded onto my computer since the last time I'd been into the iTunes store, reminding me of the darkest day in the history of digital music. I'd completely forgotten about that. But other than that, I did download that track. I actually thought it was quite good. I was ready. Not in the See Me Daily or on the Setlist podcast, obviously, but behind the scenes, I was ready to be quite cynical and scathing of it. Because, you know, that's what we're like round here. But I just thought it came together really nicely, and I thought it was a good production job. You had a bit of an issue with the audio quality on AJ Tracy's rap.
Yeah, it could have been better, but I mean, you know, people have to work with what they've got at home, haven't they?
I thought it was a really nice rap. I thought, because obviously, once hip-hop became the big genre and these charity singles came together, the first few charity singles with lots of different artists performing that tried to incorporate a rap in the middle, invariably it didn't really work. But I thought with this one, it worked really well. It was a really nice addition to the track.
Yeah, in fact, it was that updated the track for now, because the rest of it was a pretty straight cover, but he did write some new lyrics and that kind of brought it into this moment even more so.
But as is often the way with things like this, and it's true of the Captain Tom track as well, I think actually, even though I downloaded the track so I can listen to it if I want by starting up the Apple Music app, projects like this, they do generally work better when you watch the video, don't they? Because you sort of see all the artists. Well, they did that clever thing where all the artists had recorded it into a camera on their computer or in their home, but they tried to sort of make it look a little bit like some of the people were interacting in a way, even though they weren't. So I thought the video in particular was really well put together. And if I'm being honest, I would have paid to download the other BBC musical collaboration that came out last week with a COVID-19 theme, which was that weather presenter who was drumming to the BBC News theme, and that kind of went viral. He then got lots of other people, and these were not pop stars. These are just people who have musical instruments at home, like to play guitar, bang a drum, or whatever. And so he had lots of members of the public contributing to percussion on top of the BBC News theme tune. And as you know, I'm a big fan of the BBC News theme tune. I thought that was quite good as well. Unfortunately, that's not been commercially released, so I couldn't buy it and download it. But yeah, I thought both of those projects were kind of nice.
Yeah, and I think it's also nice that now AJ Tracy can put a very nice rap on his next poster. Could cite you. That's a lovely...
Well, as you know, I'm famous for my rigorous critiques of the genre of rap. And I look forward to having that appearing on AJ Tracy's press kit in the future. Hey, I wasn't the only fan of the final product. There was another big fan of the final product, and that was Dave Grohl himself. Obviously, he appears in the track, but he was very, very complimentary of the entire project and all the other contributions and how it all came together.
Yeah, I mean, he was actually quite a late addition to it. He wasn't on the original list of artists announced as being part of the track, but he kind of wholeheartedly got behind it, got involved, appeared on the track, announced that any royalties the Foo Fighters received would go straight back to the charity partners of the single. They wouldn't take any money from it. And he also wrote a really heartfelt thank you letter to the BBC.
The entire BBC.
Yeah, ahead of the track going to number one. He said, "When my manager first called and explained the project to me, I literally had to fight back tears. That's how flattered I was that the BBC would consider one of my songs for such an important cause. To all those amazing artists who took the time to learn and sing the words that I scribbled on a bit of hotel stationery nearly 20 years ago, I am beyond humbled. You have no idea."
Yeah, so for any other cynics out there, talking of cynics, I know there are some sort of, you know, bitter cynics out there who are desperate for that moment in rock history when it actually turns out that Dave Grohl is not the nicest man in music. But unfortunately, that moment in history has not happened. He has just further proved that he is one of the nicest guys making music today. So there, that was two very nice projects and stories that have been going on in recent weeks as we all navigate our way through the COVID-19 shutdown. So this week's podcast ended up being very COVID-19 centric. We've been trying to avoid that in recent weeks, but at least with some of the positive stories as well as some of the negativity as well.
We weren't very cynical. I think something must have happened. I don't know what's happened to us, but this, I'm not sure this is a CMU podcast anymore.
No, we need to ramp up the sarcasm again, either in the daily or here on Setlist, maybe just to keep things where people expect them. In the notes for this week's edition of Setlist, we can put a link to a video of Justin Bieber walking into a door and everything will be restored.
Okay, I will add that in to the additional links that I put in the show notes. But if you go and find the show notes for this episode at setlistpodcast.com, you will find links not only to that, but to everything else we've discussed here if you want to go even deeper into it. But that is all we've got time for on this edition of the show. You can subscribe, rate, and review. Like, you know that now, surely. Podcasts have been around for ages. Subscribe, rate, review. It's what you do. Everyone's doing it all day long. I do it all the time. I mean, well, I have done it. And you should do it too. You've got loads of free time at the moment. Why are you not subscribing, rating, and reviewing all the time, especially to this show, which is Setlist? And Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Moult and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an unlimited production.